So what I'm going to do is just take a few minutes here, and you know, when I do that, it might still take a half hour, but hopefully not, to set up Heinrich Mann and give you something to hold on to as you start doing that reading. So kind of quickly, let me just tell you a little bit about this guy and the background of this book. How many of you have heard of Thomas Mann? Okay, let's see. Wait a minute. I know you. Okay, what do you know of Thomas Mann? Okay. Okay. Good. Blank slate. okay. Thomas Mann is probably the I have to think this through. I don't want to make some sort of thing I'm going to get reported for. I would say he's probably the best known 20th century German author, even if that's not really represented in this classroom, right? Günter Grass, right, is a huge name as well, which, you know, sort of broke over, but let's say for the first half of the 20th century, Thomas Mann. Now those of you who know, what's his most famous short story that others might have heard of? Well, yeah, but what's the big one? What's the real novella? Death in Venice. Anybody have heard of Death in Venice? He's the author of Death in Venice. If you want to see a good, beautiful movie, Luciano Visconti did Death in Venice movie, which is really excellent. Okay, well, so I'll tell you who Thomas Mann was and Heinrich. They were the sons of a merchant family in northern Germany, a small town called Lübeck, which is near Hamburg, so north of Berlin, up on the coast. And just an aside, Lübeck's sort of an indication of these weird definitions of what Germany is, because Hamburg and Lübeck have always had special status within Germany as sort of little republics within it. Kind of like Geneva in Switzerland, if you know, they have their own administration, and it's sort of like Washington D.C., and they're linked together as port towns. Right? So they have this unique political status, and I'm not sure how much it applies now, but certainly up through the 19th century into the first half of the 20th century, this was the case. So to say that he's from Lübeck means something politically, but. They were the sons of this merchant family that had gone back three or so generations, and very, very well off. But the father, and this is something that Thomas Mann makes a huge deal of in all of his symbolism, married a Latinate woman, and she played piano, and she played Chopin, and she wasn't really part of this Lübeck, northern German race. Even if you weren't a Nazi racist anti-Semite, you thought in terms of race at the turn of the century. Churchill's always talking about race. There's the English race, right? So you know, people just are seeing things that way. And Mann saw this combination in his soul from his father and his mother, and that this is an indication that there was a decline in the family. There's a decline. This manifests itself in the fact that when he retired, the father did not pass the business on to the sons. He dissolved the business and gave the wife the profit or the estate in cash, and the business no longer existed. And then she took her sons down to Munich to raise them in this southern world of culture and Gemütlichkeit, rather than that uptight Lübeck North German world. And Thomas Mann saw all sorts of symbolism in all of this. And he worked that symbolism into a very famous first novel written at the age of 23 called Buddenbrooks, which is an incredible thing, especially when you think that he wrote it at 23. Okay. And then he went on, just because he's a little bit more famous, I'll just tell you, he went on to write collections of beautiful short stories, and that's how he built his career. And then this novella, it's a kind of a long short story called Death in Venice. And also then producing world-class novels, Magic Mountain is probably, besides Buddenbrook's, his most famous novel, which is a story of a young boy who goes up to a youth who goes up to a tubercular institution at the top of a mountain, at the top of an Alp, and there interacts with individuals who symbolize all the various intellectual, cultural, social options that Europe had at the cusp of the First World War. And this boy's imagination is, attracted to this and attracted to that. And there are these debates between some of the characters, and it's a novel of ideas. And you're trying to wonder what Hans Katzdorp is going to decide. And then, in the end, he goes down the mountain. He leaves, and he disappears in the last page into the trenches. And you don't know where he ends up. You know, you don't know if he survives or anything. You just see him go over the top and disappear into barbed wire, and into the smoke. We just don't know how it ends up. But for that novel, he received a Nobel Prize for Literature, and was then the premier German writer in the 20s, very famous globally. And was conservative, very conservative, very much a defender of the Wilhelmine culture, flag number one. And in the First World War, he actually, I mean, this is, it might throw you a little bit, but he was actually a proponent of the German interests and the hope that German culture, would be victorious over French civilization. And he established this dichotomy. More on that in a second. And then he went on, though, during the Weimar period, to recognize that the Nazis were slugs, and gradually became if slightly hesitant, supporter of the Weimar Republic against the Nazis, and in a very highly, highly rarefied intellectual way, articulated that they were slugs, and this isn't the direction that the nation should go, and ultimately went into exile. Strangely, for giving a lecture on a Freudian analysis of Wagner. So these cultural issues have poignance here. More on that later. But that got him in enough trouble that he felt he couldn't return from Switzerland. And then he ended up in Southern California with this incredible collection of German emigres, whether for political or racial reasons, in Southern California, which included Arnold Schoenberg, included Heinrich Mann, Leon Feuchtwanger, a lot of very famous people. Who wrote out the war down there, sort of off of the money of USC, UCLA, and the movie business, depending on how they were managing. And there he wrote an incredible novel called Dr. Faustus, which he wrote as the war was unfolding, and the novel unfolds with the war in the background. So he's responding directly to the war and incorporating references to all the major components of German culture back to Luther and the Middle Ages, then Luther, and forward to Nietzsche and into 12-tone composition of Arnold Schoenberg and so on. It's an incredible book if you're into this stuff. It's just unbelievable, just full of stuff that you can interpret and see how he's woven it together into this nuanced symbolic field. Right. And he never went back to Germany. He never went back. He never returned to West Germany. He made one tour to East Germany, but he left Los Angeles and went to Switzerland. I mean, his heart was broken because of what had become of his Germany. So that's Thomas Mann, and I tell you that because he's just more, people just know more about him, and it's probably very unfair. It's probably very unfair for me to have said, okay, you should know about Thomas Mann, and now I'm going to tell you about Heinrich, because actually, Heinrich was the older brother. And as an older brother, I would be really pissed off if you introduced me by first introducing my younger brother. Well, maybe I would. He makes incredible websites, which is much more useful than anything I do. Heinrich was the older brother, and actually Thomas was, you know, kind of competing and trying to catch up with his older brother at some level through his life. But they took different directions fairly early. And most importantly was their political orientation. Heinrich Mann is a leftist satirical critic of Wilhelmine culture and the roots of hyper-conservative, anti-Semitic, proto-Nazi thought from the get-go. He saw it. He saw it in pre-war Germany. He saw the problems very astutely. And he takes them on in a very practical way with satirical, realist attacks on these stereotypical Germans that he sees as troubling and dangerous. Okay, and the two of them lock heads over this, lock horns over this, and especially during the war. They don't speak to each other for the duration of the war and for some time afterward. And when Thomas Mann is arguing the war is a good thing and it's a war of culture, me, versus civilization, that's his brother, this practical leftist socialist guy whose model as an author is Zola, Emil Zola. Okay, so that divide in Thomas Mann's argument there, it's an attack on his brother, for which it was very hard for Heinrich to forgive him until later on, when Thomas Mann then, you know, they sort of became brothers again in response to the attack of the Nazis. So, just to sort of set his life within the framework of this family and this pair of very important German writers. Okay. So now let me just tell you a little bit about the Untertan, the loyal subject, and we'll call it a night. And I'll set it up a little bit more completely, and we'll think about, you know, Orlo and the major events and the major movements that we need to have in hand when we start talking about it. But we'll do that next time. Okay, Der Untertan. That's the German title for this. Der Untertan does mean the loyal subject. That's the good translation. We had a previous translation that we used last semester called Man of Straw, which is, I don't know, just sort of doesn't quite get it. The point is, Untertan is, I am a subject of the state. I'm not a citizen of the republic, of the democracy. I'm the subject of an authoritarian leader. Okay, I'm a loyal subject of the authoritarian leader. That's what the title. And the subtitle that he suggested for it, actually, at first, was the Untertan, so the loyal subject, a history of the public soul under Wilhelm II. Okay. So he is, you know, this is Zola. This is literature providing this function. It's not spiritual. It's not psychological. It's not emotional. It has this practical function. I'm going to give you an image of the public soul. It is the soul, but it's the public soul. The political type, the social type, who is emerging as dominant within this society. And it's, you're going to see, but, you know, this is the fawning I'm trying to look for a good word for it, but sycophantish, groveling worshiper of this brash, aggressive Wilhelm II culture of Germany finding its place in the sun and having its navy and, you know, getting colonies and really, you know, whether we're going to blame the Germans as the Versailles Treaty did or not. I mean, it took at least five to tango, right? But Wilhelm II had certainly stirred the pot. And what he's saying is, this is the type of person that follows this guy, who has no personality of their own, and it identifies in this, you know, there's an underlying psychological analysis there. You'll see it right from the start. That needs an authoritarian figure. You know, likes to be beaten as a boy. Needs to be led as a man. That kind of thing. Okay. Now let me just read, and I'll close with this tonight. Heinrich Mann's sort of sketch of what he intended to do in writing this book. It isn't exactly how it came out, but generally this is what he wrote in a letter or something. I think it's a letter describing what he intended to do in this book in creating the character of Dietrich Hessling, whom you're going to meet. And that name itself suggests in German something ugly. Dietrich, ugly thing. Hessling. It's ugly. It's hässlich. That's nasty. Right? So his name is sort of Dietrich Nasty. This is what Heinrich Mann said he wanted to do in this novel. I want to create heroes, real heroes, generous, gay, and loving humanity in contrast to the hostile race of today, given completely to reaction. So he would like to counter this type. But since living in Berlin, I find myself oppressed by the slave-like man without ideals. So this is the type. He just has to describe this guy. He would like to do something better, but he's got to concentrate on this, because this is the problem he sees. To the old contemptuous Prussian officer spirit, which I would give you some of the background to now, but we'll leave that for now, has been added the modern mechanical mass response of the metropolis. So the mass man, right? The mass man. It's not just the Prussian idea, the Prussian officer thing, but now it's been sort of spread out into the masses. And the result is a sinking of human dignity beyond all known measure. I am making notes. How an unimportant member of this mass is treated when he or she buys a slice of bread. So how, you know, there's this aggressive attitude. The poor or just somebody in your way, you know, just elbow them out of the way. You know, I'm on my iPhone, don't bother me. You know, move on. Sharp elbows, as the Germans might say. How at almost every opportunity, each acts as the superior and enemy of the other. Openly and brutally, as nowhere else in the world. On the station platforms, in the sweaty cafes, I sometimes have the feeling, if suddenly a police troop were to burst in and cut down 10 or 20 of those present with their swords, the others would neither miss their train nor let their pudding get cold. So he's looking at this Wilhelmine world, Germany, German Empire, on the cusp, you know, triumphant, building itself under the young Wilhelm II, and so on and so forth, and he's saying, there's something wrong here. All this I want to include, but first I must feel it in my bones before I can allow my characters to touch on this. The chief character shall be the average Neo-German, and we'll talk about that, this folkish background, which I think you can wait till the beginning next time. You'll get a feel for it as you go. One who takes the spirit to the provinces, so he goes back to his small town, a Byzantine down to his toes. My idea is to make him into a paper manufacturer, who slowly graduates to printing patriotic postcards, which show the Kaiser in battle scenes and apotheoses. Well, in the end, he actually goes further than that, and you'll see. He has him create toilet paper with the image of the Kaiser on it. That's his big patriotic action. So he goes even further than he planned to do. So you're going to get this really, you know, it's painfully funny. It's painfully funny. Image of this type that he perceived as being dangerous. Now, I'm not going to make equivalents right now, but you know, it's sort of the blue zone's view of the red zone, okay? And should be read as such. Now, just an aside, this book was written before the war, and appeared in installments as used to be done more often in newspapers or something, in a journal. But it wasn't published as a book until after the war. And then, so when it came out as a book after the war, people read it and said, my God, he He predicted it. He predicted it. He was right. So you'll see what I mean. I told you a little bit about the background of Heinrich Mann and of Det Untertan, and I'll just skim over a little of that here, and then I'll run through major passages, not retelling the whole story because I have to assume you've read through it, but jumping in and showing you, yeah, here's a passage where this comes out, and here's a passage where that comes out, and sort of underlining those with you. First of all, I want to remind you about the production and publication process of this. This book was written before the First World War, even before the outbreak of the First World War. It started to appear in serial form in newspapers in 1914. It was not published as a full text, but it started to appear in the year of 1914, so as the war was breaking out. But it was obviously conceived and written before that. It was not published as a full text until the end of the war. And when it was, in 1918, readers went, wow, he got it. He seems to have predicted what was going to happen in those 4 years. Okay. Now, historians aren't that into prediction. Most aren't. But let's just take that for a second. As you read this, you probably found yourselves going, yeah, see, anti-Semitism, militarism, sort of a aggressive form of nationalism, all the things that we'll be looking at here. If you were to write a pastiche of pre-1914 Germany with reference to the First World War and with reference to Nazism, this might be the kind of book that you would write, because you would want to highlight those themes that seem to feed into those subsequent events. Right? Well, he anticipated it. Right? He was just describing society as he saw it then. Right? So the message for us has to be these themes, these issues, these problems, we might say, right, did pre-exist the war. They were already part of German society. You don't need Hitler to get people thinking this way. It was already there in a certain circle, enough to the point where obviously Heinrich Mann noticed it, and Heinrich Mann felt that it was something that he needed to warn people about, that there were a significant minority of people in Berlin and the outskirts of Berlin who were starting to think and act this way, and he felt that he had to take up his pen and take them on. Right? So he was already concerned in 1912, 1913 about this. So that's what makes it a remarkable document, because it looks like it's retroactive, but it's not. Right? This is confirmation that these ways of thinking, these ways of talking, these issues and attitudes were already prevalent. And that leads us to what he intended to do, which was to provide a history of the public soul under Wilhelm II. Right? That was his subtitle. The Loyal Subject, A History of the Public Soul Under Wilhelm II. So it's a funny story, sort of, in a black humorous sort of way. This guy is so ridiculous, right? But his goal wasn't just to tell an entertaining story. It was to put a microscope to this, the evolution of this new type that scared the hell out of him, even in 1912 and 1913, and which seemed to be leading Germany in the direction of something horrific, although he couldn't have been sure what at that time. So it really is quite a remarkable document for that reason, that anticipated these things so carefully. Now, I see here in my notes that I picked up somewhere. He started studies for the book in 1906. In 1906. So that description of that I read to you about wanting to take on this new attitude, this new mass response of sort of anti-modernist, pro-German, pro-militarist culture. that commenced in 1906. So we really get a sense that this was these notions, these attitudes were prevalent already. Okay, let's talk about Dietrich Heseling himself. He sets this up in quite satirical, critical terms right from the very beginning, because if we just take into account Dietrich's name, you know that Heinrich Mann was drawing a very critical portrait. The name Heseling is particularly ugly in Germany. It suggests hässlich, which in German means ugly, right? So you really, it's like Dietrich Ugly. This Dietrich Ugly guy is walking around. So, I mean, right there you can get the sense of it. And I just thought I'd show you real quickly, before I forget, a couple of images that help set the stage. Now, you could thumb through a whole collection of 19th century Berlin images and 19th century German images and probably get a pretty good visual feel of the world that you're reading about. But I picked these out at some point, and I'll just run through them here. This is a pretty good photograph of a working class guy. So here are the distinctions. A working class guy in the streets of Berlin. Well, let's just imagine him to be one of Dietrich's employees. Right? This could be the employee that he has, Napoleon Fischer. Right, this could be Napoleon Fischer with a kind of a leftist orientation. But you can see at the time that a worker looked like a worker. He dressed like a worker. He had working class clothes on. So here's Napoleon Fischer type. And here's the Dietrichs. Here are the Dietrich types. Right, here they are, young, fairly young businessmen. They've gone to the university. They've been members of these fraternities, the Burschenschaften. They've got their their Wilhelm mustaches on, their bowler caps. And so on. I would say one of these guys is Dietrich, just to give you a sense of what he probably looked like. Maybe a little beefier, but that would be my take. Here we have, I would say, Agnes going out to the Grunewald. Here, the Grunewald, which they do go to, I believe, is a beautiful park just on the outskirts of Berlin. There's a lot of green lakes and so on. So there you have Agnes and her friends, fairly innocuous, sort of innocent bimbos out there in the Wilhelmine parks. And just to set it up, here's Wilhelm II. Right? I have to look again here. How did I find him? Those of you who were in class last time. If you don't know where Wilhelm is, how do you find him? Because they all look the same. They all look like Wilhelm. Right? How do you pick him out? Do you remember last time?
His withered hand.
His withered hand. Right? Okay. He had this is an important little factoid. Right? At birth, Wilhelm had a withered hand. I believe it was at birth. Okay. So you can always look to see, because it didn't really function. He had to have it tucked in a pocket or something like that. Right? It just rode along with him. And from a psycho historical standpoint, this is the source of his sense of self-consciousness and so on, which he's just overcoming with this brash persona that he projects. He's trying to constantly overcome that because he couldn't be a knight in shining armor. He couldn't be a soldier and so on. And from his youth on, he's just constantly dressing up in all of these outfits and projects this this image of the military leader. So here he is, and this is with his sons. That's Ruprecht. That's the crown prince. Death's heads are not new to the SS, by the way. I mean, they picked that up out of something that goes back to the hussars, the cavalry. They had death's heads back in the 18th century.
It actually goes back even further into the English military.
Yeah.
With, I believe, the sappers.
Yeah, I'll go with that. Sure. Nothing new, though. That's really the point, right? And it was certainly around in German military culture before. So for the SS to incorporate that and put the Dutch head on their caps.
it wasn't quite as shocking as it might seem to you, seeing it through the lens of what they did. And then this one sort of verifies that what Heinrich Mann describes, i.e., you know, businessmen, and in this case, hotel keepers, all wearing the Wilhelm mustache, right? It becomes this fashionable statement across the board. I don't think there's one man in that photograph with that one. I don't think there's a clean-shaven face in the whole thing. Not one. Right? So, you know, he's making fun of that, and it may seem kind of extreme, right? But voila. It is still based in realistic observations of turn-of-the-century German culture. Okay. Finally, let's turn to the text and start playing with that. Now, Thomas Mann, I'll refrain from going into great depth about that, although I introduced him a little bit. You might just remember, though, Heinrich Mann is certainly aware of the aesthetic of modernism that arguably Wagner initiates in German culture, that was taking place in Vienna and in Berlin and Munich with the Expressionists, that his brother is incorporating to a certain degree into his work, where you pay attention to the psychological lives of people and the impulses and the drives and so on. And Freud is becoming more and more a part of the I don't want to say daily, right, but of the intellectual configuration of the turn of the century. So you do look back to people's childhood and to their past and look for impulses and drives that were triggered at that time. And Heinrich Mann, although he's more focused on social and political reality, his model being Zola, right, more so than Nietzsche, we'll say, his star is Zola and Thomas's star is Nietzsche, right, so an internal quest, or an external quest rather than an internal one. He does pay some attention to the soul, and there is a psychological element to this. I mean, fundamentally, what is common to Thomas Mann and to Heinrich Mann, to that expressionist orientation and this socialist realist orientation, is the notion that we have a generation of people here who seem to be empty. They don't seem to have lives of their own. They are not capable of standing for themselves. They are not self-aware. They are not self-conscious. And for Thomas, this is a problem that needs to be taken care of in terms of people becoming more personally alert, more psychologically alert, paying attention to their sexual needs, paying attention to their will and how it's applying itself, because he's informed by Nietzsche. Heinrich looks at these people and says, you know, they're empty, they have nothing, and what's dangerous and what they need to be paying attention to is that they're not doing that, and they're probably not capable of it, but instead they're creating identities based on these external references. They are attaching themselves to institutions like their schools and to fraternity groups, and then that becomes the military, and then it becomes the nation, and particularly Wilhelm. So they derive some sort of persona from the outside by imitating that, by mimicking it, and that's dangerous because they're attaching themselves psychologically to the fate of the state. And they're working out their own sense of loss or insecurity, right, by demanding an increasingly aggressive foreign policy or whatever. Right. So, and you know, if we look at Kaiser Wilhelm II himself, he's also, what's the word, when you want to overcome, you want to...
Overcompensate?
Overcompensating, exactly. He's overcompensating for, you know, his sense of weakness. And that's this, so we have a whole generation that's doing that. And that's Heinrich points his finger at. So it's not a personal quest, it becomes a social one. But so I think the two of them, or the period, does open itself into both of these. And Heinrich is, although he comes off as being a little bit more simplistic than Thomas, because Thomas has this deep, rich, psychological, modernist aesthetic, and Heinrich is just the socialist critic. But really, it's Heinrich who puts himself on the tracks and tries to, you know, warn against the horrors that this public soul, this phony, overcompensating public soul, could trigger in German and European society. So, Dietrich Hessling was a dreamy, delicate child, frightened of everything and troubled frequently by earaches. Okay. So, he's got his issues right from the very beginning. In winter, he hated to leave the warm room, and in summer, the narrow garden. Right, so he's closed off, not open to the external. He was often terribly frightened when he raised his eyes from his storybook, his beloved fairy tales. So he's tapped into that German romantic culture, and he seems to find some satisfaction there, right? But he can be terrified by it. A toad half as big as himself had been sitting on the seat beside him, just as plain a day. Or over there against the wall, a gnome sunk to his waist in the ground was staring at him. So the dark side of the romantic tradition is sort of manifesting itself in Dietrich's soul. His father was even more terrible than the gnome and the toad, and moreover, he was compelled to love him. Dietrich loved him. Whenever he had pilfered or told a lie, he would come cringing shyly like a dog to his father's desk. Once, when his father, who had a stiff leg, fell downstairs, the boy clapped his hands madly and then ran away. So, Mann is definitely putting himself into this sort of Freudian position here. You know, you have issues with your dad. Your dad was cruel to you. You loved him because you were supposed to, but, you know, occasionally things would come out. You didn't really love your dad, right? So you're getting that whole sense. He's a conflicted character right from the start. The workmen used to laugh when he passed the workshops after having been punished, crying loudly, his face swollen with tears. Then Dietrich would stamp his feet and put out his tongue at them. He would say to himself, I've got a beating, but from my papa. So his father beat him, that's clear. You would be glad to be beaten by him, but you're not good enough for that. So, you know, he accepts this submissive state and actually comes to relish it, the beatings of his father. Later on, when his father dies, I mean, I don't know if we'll hit it as we go by, but what does he pay attention to as he looks at his father's body? The hand that beat him, right? The hand that beat him. That's the thing that he was most attached to. So we have this, first of all, sort of delicate and fearful figure, but then he actually derives some sort of identity with being submissive and being beaten. Now, remember what Mann's setting up here. You know, do we have a whole generation of these people who are dealing with patriarchal authority? You know, you could go crazy. I'm not going to go backwards, but you could. You know, look back at the previous generation, the founders' generation, who established all of these businesses with Bismarck and so on and so forth. They're these imperious patriarchal types, right? And then the sons of those are these sniveling little cowards. You could, you know, might be oversimplifying, but that's the kind of thing you feel backward with. Is that what Mann is saying? Right? Obviously providing some sort of psychosociological vision of the whole thing. Okay. So, page 3, let's go ahead to school. The first step into the social world. On page 3. He finally went to the school. Right? Dietrich now fell under the sway of one even more powerful authority, we'll say. One which swallowed up people up completely, the school. He was always obedient and docile with the strict teachers. So he accepts authority very submissively. On the good-natured ones, he played little tricks, which could be proved against him only with difficulty and about which he would boast. So he fools around, but within the framework of this discipline. Page 4. Dietrich was so constituted that he was delighted to belong to an impersonal entity. Here it is. Here, now this is Mann, you know, looking at this whole generation, right? He's constituted so that he was delighted to belong to an impersonal entity. There's that that larger group, whatever it is, state, nation, military, and then down to school. To this immovable, inhumanly indifferent, mechanical organization which was the school, the gymnasium. He was proud of this power, this grim power in which he participated, if only as its passive object. So this type, Dietrich, enjoys being a passive object of a superior institution or authority, right from the start. His father's hand, right, then the school. In relation to his younger sisters, Dietrich represented the power which held him in his mechanism. So he'll take the way he's treated in the institution and then apply it to others, first of all his sisters. So he internalizes that oppressing authority and then directs it on whoever gets in his way, if he has the opportunity. He made them take dictation and deliberately make more mistakes than they naturally would, so that he could make furious corrections with red ink and administer punishment. His punishments were cruel. The little ones cried, and then Dietrich had to humble himself that they would not betray him. Okay, so this is passed on, right, from one authority down to the ground. Now on page 5 we get the first signs of the presence of anti-Semitism in pre-First World War Germany. Right? And I think it's just important for us to say, well, there it is. Right? Bang. Mann saw it, makes it absolutely central to his school experience. The bottom of page 5. Once, when he was in lower third, Dietrich forgot all prudence, acted blindly, and became himself an oppressor, drunk with victory. As was the usual approved custom, he had bullied the only Jew in his class. Okay? So, in the schools, it's a usual approved custom to be bullying Jews by the first part of the 19th century, at least so that Mann would have viewed this. Now, I believe that the book is set earlier, so he's saying that this was already present in the 1880s, early 1890s, when Dietrich Hessling would have been a little boy. Out of the blocks, then he proceeded to an unfamiliar manifestation. Out of the blocks, which were used for drawing, he built a cross on the desk and forced the Jew onto his knees before it. He held him tight in spite of his resistance. He was strong. What made Dietrich strong was the applause of the bystanders, the crowd whose arms helped him, the overwhelming majority within the building and the world outside. He was acting on the behalf of the whole Christian community of Netzig. How splendid was it to share responsibility and to have a collective sense of duty. So there's the anti-Semitism, that's clear. And it is in the schools, actually, that it really first takes root. University fraternities are the first public institutions to ban Jews, officially. They're the first ones to do it. So, and that happens in the late part of the 20th century. 19th century, sorry. Go ahead.
Mann and others like him just take this idea of like maybe this anti-Semitism being derived entirely from like these impersonal like entities. So like you said that it first was banned in the universities. I don't know. I guess it just seems like I don't know if other people started to like realize this. Like didn't people who weren't anti-Semitic realize that they were like sending their kids to these like institutions where this was being drilled into their minds?
One would like to think that people acted that way, but they probably didn't. You know, it probably would have been perceived as a prank kind of thing within the schools at first and not taken seriously, and that's how these things can creep. I mean, that's one way to look at it. But unfortunately, the answer is no. I don't think people would have, you know, even the Jews would not have resisted it at that time. Of course, the world of what the British call public schools, gymnasium in Germany, the lycée in France is a world that, you know, none of you would want to have anything to do with at all, because you're, you know, much too liberated American Democrats to be able to handle that. But the European world, that is a vicious site in which authority was established and imposed. And whether you were Jewish or not, there was all kinds of such sort of oppressive treatment going on. So it wasn't that, you know, it happens to be a Jew, and that would be part of it, but it's within a framework of the senior kids imposing order on the little kids, younger kids, all the time, and this whole culture of fagging, which is where we get the word faggot, by the way, but, you know, it comes from that treatment of a younger student as dirt and as your slave, basically. So a younger student was automatically, let's say, assigned an older student and had to do everything that older student wished. And the older, and in this world, which was set up by, you know, educational and social engineers of the 19th century to create leaders in society, because these are the kids who were in the elite schools who would then go on to become the governors of the state and the governors of the empire and so on. This was encouraged, and the only thing that you could do wrong, really, within that framework, was to squeal. If a student were to squeal to a teacher, the squealer would be out, right? Not those who had perpetrated whatever was being reported, because that's a breaking of ranks. It had to be taken care of by the students themselves within that world, right? So, I mean, I'm going too far with this, but Tom Brown's School Days is the great novel of this whole environment, and it is a universal one in the elite educational world of Europe. So it's just a small portion of what Mann's pointing out here, but I think within that framework, the anti-Semitic treatment would have been inconsequential. But it is important that Mann sees it and saw it, and even, you know, well before the Nazis ever showed up, is pointing out that there were people acting that way. Okay, so moving ahead, what time is it? 5:30. Let's move to his engagement with the fraternity system. Okay. Starting at about page 1819. The Neo-Teutons. There's obviously a reference to the German past. That term shows up on page 17, actually. That's the second to last full paragraph there. Dietrich would have joined them elsewhere. They was known as the Neo-Teutons, a most select student corps. I don't know if your book provides this term, but the term I'm going to be using, I don't know if it translated or not. No.
It's Burschenschaften. And these are it's literally, you know, a society of boys. It's sort of slang for boys. But this is the term for fraternity groups, the Burschenschaften. Now they've existed in Germany probably before, but certainly since the Romantic period. And they were organized. These fraternity movement was organized as part of the liberation movement underneath Napoleon. And the father of the fraternity movement in Germany was a man named Jan. Vater Jan, Father Jan, and he was also involved with organizing gymnastics movement. And the whole idea was to provide a sense of camaraderie and bonding among young men, and then the gymnastics was to strengthen them and make them more capable as physically for military purposes, ultimately. And it was conceived of that as part of the national unification effort. So So there's a political dimension to those things right from the start, and that's existed for, by this time, most of the century. And
it is in the Burschenschaften that you do the strain of anti-Semitic, anti-modernist thought, the folkish strain, takes its first institutional hold. And I'm just going to write that word up there in case you didn't catch it last time.
Again, the Americanized version is this, folkish. Reference to the folk. That's instead of
which does mean folk, right? F-O-L-K, but in Germany it means something completely. It's that total notion of Germany as a Germans as a spiritual unit. And it has all these sort of quasi-spiritual implications. So folkish culture is those groups that were referring not to the German nation as such, as Bismarck had arranged it via real politics, right, but the imaginary community that would include all of, you know, all the German from Silesia to Milwaukee. Right, so that's and in opposition to the Jews. So back to 1819, he trips into this world of the Neo-Teutons, so new Teutonic Knights. Right? The name itself obviously suggests that folkish medieval culture that rejects the modern. And observes them and then gradually joins them. Page 18. Five lines down. Whether he drank or not, whether he sat or stood, spoke or sang, rarely dependent on his own will. Everything was ordered in a loud voice, and if you followed orders, you could live at peace with yourself and all the world. So he's found another environment which provides him with an identity, right? and a set of rules, a set of guidelines by which he can arrange his life, right, without the responsibility of figuring things out for himself and making decisions and so on. Very satisfying to him. He felt cozily ensconced. Third paragraph down, page 18. In the shadow of the low-ceilinged room, decorated in old German style, right? So there's that new medieval style that's so popular among the those of this folkish orientation, with the students' caps on the wall. Around him was the ring of open mouths, all singing the same songs and drinking the same drinks, and the smell of beer and human bodies from which the heat drew the beer again in the form of perspiration. He had sunk his personality entirely in the student corps, whose will and brain were his. That's the first. And he was a real man. And it has this whole chivalrous, manly culture, who could respect himself and had honor because he belonged to it. Nobody could separate him from it or attack him individually. So we have this whole sense, I think, built in, which is probably good. Sometimes it causes a lot of stress and strain of individualism. And that's what that we, you know, we all want to retain our individuality, and even though we're buying all our clothes from H&M and The Gap and Old Navy, we think that we're, you know, individualistic. Right? And we all think uniquely and so on. And that's what we celebrate. But you have to, one shouldn't forget that there is this tendency to want to belong. Right? So we do identify ourselves with groups, and you know, I think that probably the most heinous example of that are Bears fans, right? Association with the Bears and this whole anti-Packer thing, which I've never really understood, but you can see that. I'm a Bears fan, right? I have that identity. Right? We see it in sports in general. So, I mean, all kidding aside, I'm a Packer fan, I'm a Badger fan. That's where we feel that sense of community. You're not going to a big state school, but if you do go to a big state school, there is something about those games where you've got the red on and the whole student body is out and you all know these songs and you do these ritual things. And at Wisconsin, the alma mater song, the whole stadium actually puts his arm out and goes like this. And I can tell you, it is a buzz. It is really a buzz. When you hit that stanza in that song and the whole stadium starts to move its arm back and forth in unison, and you literally, where's the line? Sink your personality entirely in the student body of the university. Right? There's that this sort of a spiritual identity there. Right? So it's not that far from us, but we've sort of isolated it in sports, which is probably a good place for it to be. But can't discount this stuff automatically. Okay. So bottom page 19, beer, alcohol. You sat there and could always get more. Beer was homely and true, not like a coquettish woman. With beer, there was nothing to do, to wish, to strive for, as there was with women. Everything came by itself. You swallowed and already something was accomplished. You were raised to a higher sense of life. You were a free man, inwardly free. Yes, beer raised one so high above oneself that one had a glimpse of deity. Now, I read that section not to teach you anything about Germany, but just to nod in agreement.